last-minute replacement in the schedule. That means I had about 24 hours to figure out what I would tell you today, most of which I spent sitting in other people's talks. So altogether, I have a very, very vague idea of what I will be talking about, and I'm relying on your cooperation to fill up 1 hour. So Rob had the idea that I could talk about a paper that I recently finished with you, which was on the archive this week, which is called Conservative Solutions to Black Hole Information Loss Problem. So I will tell you a bit what is in the paper, and then we can discuss this. So the paper doesn't actually provide any new results. It's basically a classification of solution attempts to black hole information loss problems. So what we've tried in the paper is to provide a point of view that is a bit different from the usual classification. And as such, a point of view is, of course, subjective. So I think this raises some discussion. Okay. So to begin with, I should probably state what the problem is on the risk that I'm repeating something you've heard 1 million times. In this discussion, I want to restrict myself to real black holes. And with that, I mean black holes that are formed dynamically in reality. So I want to interpret Schwarzschild black holes, that kind of thing. Uncharged and non-rotating, just to make it simpler. And I want to have space times that are asymptotically flat. So this is just to constrain the options that one has. Okay, so the conformal diagram of the black hole you've all seen a million times. So here's the horizon, here's the singularity, square plus and square minus. And then there is some collapsing matter. So that's what I mean with the real black hole. So inside, there is no real Schwarzschild solution, but it's some dynamical thing. The horizon forms and the matter falls into the singularity. So one could be bothered by this if there is an observer sitting at infinity, because if, so this is strikingly symmetric, so the only way to consider this meta distribution is that it depends on the radial coordinates, so there are no parallelism or that kind of thing. The observer that sits here at Scribe Plus, the only thing he notices is the total mass of the thing. So he could say, well, all this information that wasn't this exact distribution, he never hears anything about this. However, that's not really a problem because, well, so in the space-time, the black hole is still there, right? So it just sits there. You can take a point of view, okay, so all this stuff fell into the horizon, but it's still there. You just can't see it. So that's not the problem. The problem only comes in if you add Hawking radiation, in which case the diagram takes this form. So this again is the collapsing star, and it forms the singularity, then evaporates and it shrinks down. And what you have in this case is you have an asymptotically flat space, so this matter distribution could have been arbitrarily diluted. It evaporates, and in the end you have Hawking radiation, which we know is thermal, so this thing is again asymptotically flat position. And then you have a problem, because then you don't know where the information went. So we started off with a state that you can specify arbitrarily, but what comes out is thermal radiation. And it's thermal radiation no matter what you started with. And that's the problem. Okay. So why do people talk about this so much? After all, there is a singularity here. And we know that we can really trust general relativity near singularity. So the reason why people discuss about this so much is that there seems to be no easy way to blame our not understanding of this information loss on regions in which quantum gravitational effects become strong. Expect quantum gravitational effects to become strong? Well, when some curvature components come to the Planckian regime, that would be somewhere around the singularity. It would typically not be at the horizon, because the horizon can be formed at an arbitrarily small background curvature. So there is no reason to expect anything funny to happen where the horizon forms. So then the options that are typically discussed go somewhat like this. So this evolution could just be non-unitary. You could just accept this thermal radiation all the way down until the shrinking black hole has reached the Planckian region. And then several things can happen. So the evaporation could just stop, in which case you have a massive remnant. Now, just to very briefly summarize the arguments, I will come to this later in more detail. So the argument is then, well, you have this remnant, and during this evaporation, no information has come out, so the remnant has to carry all the information. But if they all look equal, these are remnants. So you have an infinite amount of remnants, and they all have the same mass. And this gives you a cap production problem. I will explain this later in some more detail. So you would get an infinite amount of remnants produced in arbitrarily weak background, which is obviously something we don't see. So we don't want any remnants. So then you could say, well, the information comes out in the late stages, again, when quantum gravitational effects can become strong. But then the problem is this has to take a very long time, because the thing is so small, and you have to get out a large amount of information, which means for every bit you only have very small energy, and the emission of every bit takes a very long time. But then this thing is, for practical purposes, pretty much indistinguishable from the massive remnant. So if you have a long-lived stable remnant, you get the same problem as with the massive remnant, so we don't want that either. So then what you are left with is that the information comes out early, which means basically you'll have to push it through the horizon. And that typically implies given on local effects, or it requires some modification from the semi-classical limit in regions where you would not expect any quantum gravitational effects.
So can I ask a question here?
Yeah.
it's a little tangential to what you're saying about this argument that Hawking put out 3 or 4 years ago, saying, okay, now I think there should be no information problem and so on. When we tried to read the details of what he was saying, okay, they were a little sketchy, but they looked like it was basically a random scenario, in the sense that the information would come out not in the Hawking radiation, but much later. Is that true?
So what I mean with RAMNet is really that it does not come out.
Right. But RAMNet slowly leak out information over exponentially long time. In principle, that's always possible. It just doesn't come out in the Hawking radiation.
Yeah, you would still have a problem with the
Kepler rationality. Yeah, no, I agree. I'm not saying RAMNet are a good thing. I'm just saying that, would you agree that that's exactly what Hawking's arguments would lead you to if you took them seriously and tried to follow them? I mean, they were a little sketchy, but he was using some Euclidean arguments and so on. If you try to pin down what he was really saying, I think his radiation was not coming out in the Hawking, his information not coming out in the Hawking radiation.
Well, I think what he was basically saying is there is no problem. So I think he was a bit fuzzy on the details of exactly how the problem is solved. So I'm afraid I will be pretty fuzzy. So, but I will come back to the RAMNet thing later, so we can talk about this then. So, okay.
Excuse me. So, Eric, you're assuming that the breakdown of quantum gravity ought to come.
Breakdown of quantum gravity?
Or the breakdown of semi-classical gravity and the enhancement of quantum gravitational effects has to come from a large local invariant.
Yeah, well, that's just, you know, so the title of the paper says something with conservative, so I'm trying to be as conservative as possible. In my conservative opinion would be if I write down a Lagrangian, the higher order correction should go with this.
So you would consider a large non-local invariant, like the relative blue shift between an asymptotic observer and a point near the horizon, you would consider that not conservative? Because that's
well,
a fairly well understood way
for
it.
It's not an invariant statement.
It is an invariant statement, but it's not a local. It's not a local invariant, but it is an invariant.
The blue shift
between an asymptotic observer and a static observer at the horizon.
Yeah, but maybe we're getting ahead of the discussion.
No, I was just asking.
What was the question? Would I consider this a quantum gravity?
So you would consider that not conservative?
The existence of the revolution?
That mechanism for the breakdown of classical gravity.
I would consider that not conservative, yes.
All right.
Okay, so what I'm going to tell you roughly is that the problem is not the horizon, but it's the singularity. So this is roughly what I have to say. Now I have to try to fill the last 40 minutes. Okay, so why am I telling this? So singularity is generally something that you want to try to avoid, right? It's kind of unappealing. You don't want it to cross your path. So singularities are typically something where some observers diverge, where things come to an endpoint, and they appear in theories generally only because you haven't considered when a theory breaks down. So you would expect the singularity not actually needed to be there if you consider quantum gravitational effects. But the important thing about the singularity is that something runs into infinity. And infinity is always infinity. It's infinity, it's infinity, it's infinity, no matter what state you started with. So that's the important thing. The singularity thus leads in a certain sense to an irreversible evolution. You can start with whatever state you want to, whatever energy was in the singularity, it's always the same thing, it's always infinity. So singularity is in some sense the great equalizer, if you want to call it like this. Okay, so what I will try to do in the following is that I will suggest a generalization of the classical definition for a singularity that can be applied to a space time that has one gravitational regions. So the problem is that if there are strong quantum gravitational effects here, talking about a metric or geodesics or something like this might no longer be meaningful. So one needs some more general definition of this. Then I will see whether we can make some general statements about the possible solutions that Rodkin can have. Okay, the spacetimes that I will be interested in are those with initial conditions that would classically lead to the formation of black hole. Okay, so then we need two things. The one is what a horizon is. So when I say horizon, I always mean a real event horizon, not a different horizon. So that is an easy one. The space time has an increased horizon because that's a topically future region, which basically means, well, there are some regions that cannot single out to spread plus. So this is just the usual definition. Why does it work also in the case if you have regions where you can have one gravitational effect? Because it doesn't say anything specific about that region. Right? So the region is hidden, but there could be whatever going on. Now, try to do this for the singularity. While trying to avoid saying something about geodesics that can continue the curvature invariance blowing up to infinity, something like this, what I'll try is just to generalize what I just told you is characteristic of the presence of singularities generally is that time evolution is not reversible. So, this definition says that the evolution from any complete space-like hypersurface to any other should be reversible. So that means any hypersurface in any slicing. Okay, now if you look at it from this perspective, then what I was trying to tell you is kind of follows from this kind of trivial, right? So if space-time has a singularity, then it means the evolution is non-reversible. So if the evolution is non-reversible, it can't be unitary. So you have a problem with quantum mechanics. Now, Okay, so reversibility is of course necessary but not sufficient to have unitarity. So in principle, you could envision that you have some evolution given by a reversible law that is not unitary. But if you would put in some plausibility conditions on your quantum theory, in the sense that probability is conserved, then this would constrain the theory to unitary evolution. So I'm not saying you can actually.
Why is that? Because I could imagine, say, something, I could imagine an isometry which basically gets a state into a bunch of other states that are orthogonal from.
I'm not saying you can reverse that. I'm just saying that you could plausibly imagine that once you have reversible evolution, you can have unitary evolution.
I can also imagine I can have reversible evolution, which is not unitary.
But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to say what is the obstacle? The obstacle to having unitary evolution is that it's not reversible to begin with. Once you have it reversible, you can try to make it unitary. But basically what I'm trying to say is as long as you have a singularity there, you have a problem. Okay. But that's of course true. So removing the singularity doesn't necessarily solve the problem. But as long as the singularity is there, you still can have a problem. That's basically what I'm trying to say. Of course, that does not solve the problem in the sense that it doesn't actually tell you how to get the information out. Okay. Now, what I'll do now is that based on this, I would try to classify the solutions into what we call conservative and radical solutions. So, this was the Japanese terminology, but it kind of stuck. So,
will you explain what your criterion is for that classification?
Yeah, I'm about to say it. What I call radical is a departure from the semi-classical limit where I expect it. So that means there are some strong quantum gravitational effects where the curvature is not in the quantum regime. So that includes everything that is non-local. And so the phosphorus, for example, would be a case of this, because in this case you have non-negligible modifications around the horizon, no matter what the curvature is.
The holographic principle is also an example.
I meant to say something about Don's talk yesterday. So this kind of scenario is not covered by this perturbative holography that he was talking about. So I think this was what Raphael was trying to say. So if you have some density distribution like this, typically itself a set of pressure-free dust that is collapsing, it never reaches the boundary yet, which stays in the body. So this argument that he was making about stuff that happens here doesn't really apply to the information that is included in the actual collapsing matter.
But Don would argue that with the full quantum effects taken into account, it is, right? I was a little confused by what Don was claiming about that. He seemed to say that classically it already was, and quantum mechanically he would hope it was. Is that correct?
But he was not. He was only talking about perturbations. So he was talking about the scenario where you know, the thing with the gravitational waves. So they always reach the boundary. So these were the states that he was concerned with. If you put something on the bar, that never communicates with the boundary. Like you have huge degeneracy of these states.
Okay, so that's the linear thinking. Because he was saying using linear physics at that time, he got the waves. You're saying this is non-linear. That's where the difference is.
I'm not sure whether...
Well, I think it does reach a boundary. I mean, you can measure the mass. You could stick something in the middle and measure the mass.
Yeah, sure. You can reach the integrated quantities. But what you will never see at the boundary is this distribution. You will see the total mass. And you, what I was saying is you have a lot of options how this row will look like. Okay, so and the conservative options are just those that are not radical. Okay, so the approach that I'm trying to take is basically saying, well, what is the most plausible thing that should come out by investigating this problem? And I would think, well, that the first thing that you should do is you remain conservative. So no radical solution. I just see where this gets us. So that means in particular, there are no modifications to the Hawking radiation until really the very, very late stages. So one consequence of this that is that it tells you that the volume interpretation of the black hole actually cannot be the right thing. This was also what Raphael was talking about yesterday. The reason is roughly that you start with some initial matter distribution that can carry an arbitrary amount of energy. Then it evaporates. But the Hawking radiation doesn't carry any information, so the information has to stay in. Which means that you end up with a state that would be somewhere in the Planckian regime that needs to have the possibility to encode an arbitrarily large information. But if you're bothered by going into the Planckian regime, you don't have to do this. You can also take a black hole, throw in some stuff, let it evaporate down a bit, throw in some more stuff, and so on and so forth. So it's called the Hawking radiation cycle, and you arrive at the same problem. That you can throw in stuff, you throw in information, but nothing comes out. So this means you would have black holes with the same mass but different information content.
If you don't keep throwing stuff in, then it sounds like you get remnants, or you don't want to call them remnants.
If you don't keep throwing
stuff in, you get Planck mass objects, which carry an arbitrary amount of information. That's usually what's called remnants.
Well, yeah, I said I only call them remnants if they are actually stable in the sense that they are forever there.
But so how long do these things live once they're
long time.
Okay. Well, so
then it's a remnant.
My terminology is I call it a remnant. It's really, really eternal. And you have, but I will come to this in a minute. It's just how I call it. I know that other people have used it differently. But.
Terminologically independently, there's a fact that if you have very long-lived objects of Planck scale that can carry the information of a black hole, you have these species hair production problems.
Yeah.
Okay,
right.
So you're going to address that.
And as good as I can.
Can I also ask, if you had a volume interpretation, is that the category in which you put these so-called monsters?
No, I was about to say this. So the interpretation has nothing to do with the monsters themselves. But what the monsters tell you is that the volume interpretation does make very much sense. So here's it again, the back of row. That's supposed to be an embedding diagram. So this is the asymptotically flat region. And this is a region that can have a very strong curvature. So the thing is that these bags of gold. So these are actually known solutions that can be explicitly constructed. And they have been known for a very long time. Even before we was talking about the bags of gold, they have been discussed as semi-closed words and so on and so forth. So what they have in common is that they can have a very small surface but an arbitrarily large volume.
These are time-independent solutions, right? You can make a static solution like this. This is time-independent static, you can make static solutions.
No, they all have similarities. They have similarity columns. But, the similarity is removed by some gravitational effects. So, and what Steve Azu, I think, and Laurent mentioned him yesterday, the first class monsters are states that linger very close by being a black hole. So he basically puts a lot of matter into a very small region of space-time, which creates a significant amount of gravitational interaction energy, you could call it like this. And this allows you to have asymptotically, potentially arbitrarily small in the M mass, even though there is a lot of stuff in there, and the volume can get arbitrarily large.
And if you leave it, but those solutions are static, right? They don't collapse into a black.
Yes, they collapse.
This is
on the slide. So this is the initial condition, then you let it go and it will collapse.
What happened to these when they evaporated away?
That's a good question. So the question about these things is not so much actually how you form them. I don't think that's the problem. The question is how do you get rid of them? I mean, how would you get something like this? Well, roughly I just told you, right? After you take your space-time and you form a black hole and you let it evaporate. Right. What do you have in the end? Well, you have an object that has a small surface over here, but it needs to carry an arbitrary large amount of energy. So you would probably end up with something like this. The problem is not to get them, the problem is to get rid of them. Once you have them.
If these little bags of gold exist, I mean, would they be radiated away from black holes as well?
Okay. No,
the geometric objects, but. Usually, the argument about why you can't collapse something with more entropy than a black hole into a black hole is that. It'll essentially just, the black hole will just exist for a second, will hardly exist, will essentially just. So if I have hyperentropic objects and try and collapse them into a black hole, then the black hole, because it can radiate away hyperentropic objects, and they're actually forms. And does that argument work here about why the black hole shouldn't?
Are you saying that in the black hole radiation, there should also be this highly entropic object?
Well, for other hyperentropic objects, it's usually the argument that people make about why you couldn't form a black hole with hyperentropic objects.
Which was the density of space is very high.
That's right. And you don't actually form a black hole, it just basically evaporates before it can form. So I guess it's not.
Yeah, so but the question is whether these objects would be in the Hawking radiation. So I think that's a different question. But
if it is in the Hawking radiation, then you don't expect it.
I would argue they are not, but at least until the very late stages. So as long as the Hawking temperature is below the temperature of the dream, I will maybe have them. Okay, what I was trying to do was basically I was just saying This is what you get if you just accept there is really no information in the Hawking radiation. And you are then left with three possible outcomes. So the one possibility is that this black hole forms somewhere here, and then there is some null ray where the horizon would have been, the event horizon. This thing starts evaporating. And shrinks. So you have some kind of jet surface that approaches this horizon, which then shrinks. You have some quantum gravitational region that would be somewhere around r equals 0. So this is r equals 0. This is somewhere here, so we don't really know what's going on there. And eventually, this apparent horizon shrinks down to the Clarkian regime. We don't really know what's happening there, but assume that this horizon actually vanishes. So this is the state, this is the scenario in which the information would come out late. There is no horizon. There is an apparent horizon, but there is no real imaginary horizon. So this was the case that you were referring to, where you would generically expect these things to be very long-lived. Okay, and then there are the cases where they do not actually evaporate. So there is the case where you have massive remnant. So this is again a region where you could have quantum gravitational effects. They don't necessarily have to be throughout all this region. I'm just saying they could be. So this is again the end state of the evaporation. So if you had formed a black hole, then the horizon belonging to the initial mass would have been somewhere here. This thing evaporates down, but it doesn't completely evaporate. So you are left with a space-time that still has a horizon, so this remnant just sits there. So it's stable, doesn't evaporate. These solutions have been discussed extensively, so they come with a lot of names, like Plancons, Informons, Maxmons, and so on and so forth. So nothing of what I'm saying is actually really new. So the other thing that can happen, so this would correspond to this thing. Is that this interior actually does really disconnect. So, and it forms a baby universe. So this is supposed to say there is no causal connection between this asymptotically flat patch over here and this interior. So you have a topology change here, this is a closed universe, and the information just stays there.
So an observer on the outside would see true information loss. Is that okay?
Yeah, but the information would be conserved if you consider the if you complete the type of surface. So you have like two parts, this one and this one. So the evolution would be unitary if you take them together, but for the outside observer, you would get mixed set and it would not be unitary. I mean, it's the same here, right? You have this interior region that is disconnected, you don't know what's going on, you try some state, you get non-unitary. Okay, now, of course, people have discussed that, and the most often raised objection to that kind of scenarios is the pair production problem.
So in your definition, this baby universe scenario, does it correspond to a remnant?
Corresponds to
remnant,
non-unitary.
Yeah, although that discussion has been taken further also, but there are all kinds of sort of next consistency requirements one has to impose on this splitting up of baby universes.
You're talking about the virtual
you have to, because at least in order to not destroy other things that would really lead to inconsistencies, you have to include the possibility that the baby universe also can reconnect with our universe. And also you have to integrate over, essentially for energy conservation, you have to sort of integrate over all. This can happen at all times. And then in the end, you actually get to the real baby universe story, that the state of the that's being taken out, since it can reconnect, essentially leads to dynamical coupling constants in our universe. And then the next stage of the question is, okay, well, what is the value of those dynamical coupling constants? If you measure those, it actually turns out that those that whole gas of baby universes that reconnects to our universe goes into some pure state, and if you end up that pure state is a super selection sector, and then you're back to the unitary scenario. At least that's the discussion that took place at people.
But this is what I knew as the thing with the virtual black holes, virtual baby black holes, right? You have this gas with all the possible things that can happen, and then you have the problem that you need to formulate a quantum theory that is
that plays
in this whole multiverse of other baby universe and so on. So I was actually thinking much simpler here, right? So there's this asymptotic reach, and there is one baby universe.
Although one of the things that one is trying to do here, and this comes back maybe a little bit to the question of what you call conservative and radical, is if we're talking about large black holes, where these non-locality are a superphysical size, then maybe I would agree that the most conservative solution would just be to say, well, let's forget about unitarity. It's meaningless for those kind of objects anyway. But we're trying to learn something about the microphysical laws. At least that's why we're looking at the problem, is that it gives us a hint of what quantum gravity, or at least what short distance physics would look like. And when it comes to short distance physics, the notion of what is conservative and what is not conservative is different than if we're just looking at one single large black hole. So the question is indeed, what are going to be the lessons that we're going to learn about the laws of short distance physics? And then we need to sort of at least ask the follow-up question, okay, what does it mean that these things can be created?
Yeah, so that was what I was about to talk about, the pair-production problem. So the way this argument is usually put goes something like this. We have this space-time, and we have this remnant sitting here. So let's just consider this is really a permanent massive remnant that sits there. It has a mass about Planck mass. It has a size that is about Planck size. So it's tiny. It's basically, for practical purposes, a point particle. So you should be able to describe it by some effective theory. Now, in the low energy limit of this effective theory, and low energy meaning much smaller than the Planck mass, these things should be virtually indistinguishable. They all look like, they all have the same mass, they all have the same size, they just sit there. Now, the problem is, if you consider Schwinger-Pell production, in a background field, and a background field can be arbitrarily weak. This process is mediated by these low energy couplings. And the low energy couplings are insensitive to whatever goes on in the background because it's small. This means whenever you have a system that can provide the total energy of care of these things. So the Planck mass is not macroscopically such a large a mass, so there should be fields where intuitively you would be able to reach it. Then you can make a pair of these remnants. But they are all the same, and there's a potentially infinite number of them. So whatever the outcome is of producing, whatever the outcome is for the cross-section of producing one pair, you'll have to multiply it with infinity. And then you have a problem, because then you produce an infinite amount of these pairs.
So there was an argument where I think Ms. Strominger and come some time back that, you know, more and more complicated remnants have deeper and deeper sort of throats or the data
right.
stored further down.
Yeah.
So in the end it's still possible that their production cross section keeps going down and down and then
right.
the integral could still be finite.
Yeah, so that was what I was about to say. I mean I'm not saying I have some solution to this problem. But this argument doesn't appear particularly plausible for me. For one, because what you just said, this thing really can have an arbitrarily large volume. You could have some long wavelength but actually also in the inside. The other thing is the question whether looking at an effective theory is a good thing to do to begin with. Because what you usually do to write down some effective limit is that you take apart the long wavelength from the short wavelength. Now, if you get close to the horizon, then the typical thing that happens is you can start with an arbitrarily long wavelength somewhere out here. But it will get very, very blue-shifted if you come to the horizon. So there is no separation of long and short wavelengths that would hold in the whole space-time. So, to me, there is a great question mark here, and also here, because the question is how exactly do these couplings look like if these things have an arbitrarily large internal volume? Do you have a question?
So, just a comment about remnants, which is that, so when people assume that you can have these long-lived, or these remnants are at least these long-lived objects, which look like remnants, and they assume that they must therefore have high entropy. It's essentially based on this classical notion of entropy, which is that if I want to get information out, it's additive, meaning that if it's, you know, I need to basically transfer bit by bit the information inside this object, outside this object.
Yeah.
But in quantum systems, and if I'm thinking about kind of, you know, classical information carried by quantum systems, that's actually not necessarily true. You can have kind of blocking effects where you have where the thing that's outside looks completely mixed, and the stuff that's inside can kind of release it by only releasing a few bits of information. So it's just, it's not necessarily that the previous discussions I think were based on that very classical notion, and I think it's worthwhile to kind of look at that a bit more carefully because you can get these locked in.
Yeah, so I think this is actually a slightly different point, which was actually the next one that I was about to come to. So this is really for the remnants, the stable ones that do not evaporate. So, you know, once they reach this mass, the temperature goes to zero. But then there's the question whether you have this case. The states that you produce here are actually really long lived. So, this is the argument against this kind of scenario is that the states you produce here they take a very long time to evaporate. Why do they take a very long time to evaporate? Because you have this large amount of information in them. But you have a very small energy. So per each bit that you need to emit, you only have a very small amount of energy available. And it takes a long time to emit such a small amount of energy. And in addition to this, you can't emit all the bits together because they all have to come out of this small volume. They all have to come out of this small remnant. So if you would emit them all together, the wave function would overlap and you couldn't encode the information. Therefore, it takes a very long time to emit all the information bit by bit. And you can estimate how long this takes. It takes a very long time. So the actual scaling is not so important. So I'm a bit undecided actually on this question, whether they necessarily have to be long-lived. The thing is that if you look into the literature, what people have actually computed about this thing, it doesn't seem so conclusive to me. So there are basically two papers. Just so you don't have to dig them out if anyone is interested. So in the first paper, they provide some very general estimates that are based on the assumption that the volume of the thing is small. So they are not considering that this might be a bag of gold, which has a large volume, and then they pull an argument about the overlap of the wave function. They are saying, well, it takes very long to emit all of these particles, and they get a very large number. The other argument, which is this, is they use a moving mirror analogy to describe the Hawking evaporation, which, well, if I understand it correctly at least, assumes that there is a horizon still present. That's what the mirror is. So, which is not so clear if you have a quantum gravitational.
There's also a literature in just the entropy bound literature. There's also a lot of entropy bound literature, which I think even volume precision is entropy bounds on how fast you can transfer information away from.
So that
even preceded the Bekenstein bound. I think Henry would probably be the first.
Yeah, maybe you can give me some reference on this. I've come across some of these, but yeah, I wasn't really able to separate the different arguments. So. So what I was trying to say is that in both cases, the arguments against these possibilities seem to me not so particularly convincing. So it is certainly true that people have tried to construct models that would not suffer from this problem and they failed. On the other hand, that does not exclude that it is possible to construct a model that does not fail. So I only have one more sentence to say. I have something else to say.
Still, there's the problem, right? That if this thing is itself not heavy, it's light, and it carries a lot of information,
then
it has to do things slowly in order to not exceed, not use more energy than its mass to emit stuff. That's independent of the size of, that argument is independent of the size.
Yeah, I always thought that was the strongest argument.
Right. And simply that the modes that have to be emitted
have to be
very low energy because.
Well, they are low energy at infinity.
Well, it's also that you need to separate the peaks of the stuff you're sending out. So if you're
at least it's large, you can do that. It's a large object that you're emitting from. I think it'd have to be way too large that it's not really a relevant argument. If it was very large, you can imagine doing it all at the same time in parallel. But I think that has to be really large for you to be able to do that. I suppose that's the size restriction.
Yeah, so I personally don't have a large problem with long-lived remnants. I was just mentioning this for completely. So you could put me in the other option, me, I guess. Okay, so one of the things that I wanted to say about the notion of singularity that I've used. The obvious question is, how does this relate to the notion of culture singularity? So I can't answer this question because the stance I've been taking was I can't say anything about the theory of quantum gravity. But if we had a theory of quantum gravity, then it might be possible that it has some notion of diverging operators that belong to the curvature and so on and so forth. So you could have a different notion of what it means to be singular. And then ask the question, how does this relate to the definition that I've given? So I can't really tell, but the point is they must not necessarily be related. In three cases that I could come up with. So the space-time might be quantum singular, so that was this notion of singular. But the observables that are propagating in the space time. I will actually question time. might not feel this. They just might not resolve the singularity or not run into it, whatever. The information is redistributed elsewhere before it hits the singularity, so there could be some non-local effect again. Or the singularity itself can carry information. So that means that the singularity would not be unique. So what I started with was saying, well, infinity is affinity if it is affinity. So if you put an additional degree of freedom on the singularity, that must not be the case. So this is something that one can tell you about. So I'm just mentioning this. Okay, and then I have a conclusion.
I guess before you go to your conclusion, maybe I could ask you this. Do you see any hint here of the kind of rapid tunneling I was trying to talk about yesterday towards the end of my talk? If you have a large entropy in any region, then somehow one must take that into account. This is, so here you haven't talked much about the actual summation that gives rise to this entropy. But I guess the point I was trying to make was there's a large entropy. Somehow there are large domains where you can't trust classicality because the number of solutions you can tunnel to grows exponentially and becomes large at the same rate the amplitude of the bottom falls down. Will that change any of your pictures here?
It's related.
Yeah, I guess exactly. Once you get to runners, but the point was much before you get to runners, the thing is still big. Doesn't matter how big you take it. You think if it's very big, the tunneling amplitude is very small. If you just compute R root minus G over 3 kilometers, okay, that's a huge suppression of the action. But the number of states is also exponential of 10^10^77 for solar mass black hole. And you find the two numbers just compensates these three total out. So you haven't sort of taken that entropy issue into account in any of these. But if you do, all these pictures might change.
To be honest, it's not perfectly plausible to me. I would have to look into it closer. So I thought that the tunneling into the slightly entropic space is highly improbable.
So you mean this amplitude is very suppressed?
That's what I would have thought, yes. So
but what do you say to the fact that suppression in fact is large, but it's exactly compensated by the number of such states?
Yeah, that what I just said, I would have to agree.
Yeah, okay.
It's not a priori plausible to me how that can be.
Okay. You don't think they need not be the same magnitude, you're saying? They may not be cancelling effects.
Okay, So the conclusion is pretty cool. We need a better understanding of these end states of the evaporation that will generically be of very, very high entropy squeezed within a small surface area. Okay, so I'll stop here.
So you're essentially considering it a radical point of view that these large boosts that relate observations outside of the black hole and observations by someone who is falling into the black hole, there's exponentially large boost between the two. And essentially people have argued that because of that, at least that the argument for why information has to disappear into the black hole, or the argument for why, from the perspective of the outside observer, that the interior of the black hole should be considered as a classical real space-time or semi-classical space-time. Again, that is no longer considered to be, one has debated whether that's a conservative conclusion or not, whether this diagram that you're drawing there is really a globally valid space time diagram. And you consider that valid.
Yeah. So this was my criterion for
Because of the locality, because you said you just take a local.
Yeah, what I have in mind is like the action, right? Expansion of the action, and when do we IR on the trips, where would they be coming from?
Yeah, but the questions that one can answer from perspective. So the formalism in which this kind of argument applies is indeed if you write down some effective action and you're interested in the local questions, but the question of information has to do with relations between observables. The real question is, are the observables that the asymptotic observer has to his or her disposal, are they orthogonal, or are they somehow overlapping with observables that are associated with someone falls inside? And that question itself may not be directly formulated in terms of this effective field theory in which that kind of.
But that would still ask for a local process for what actually happens.
Right, that's in principle, that's a practice. But,
can I ask you just look at one of the figures in your paper there where you have this baby universe coming out of this. Do you have the diagram on the board somewhere?
Yeah, I have it on the board.
I digressed.
Yeah, I think that was exactly the board that I guess,
okay.
But I know what.
And anyway, I have it in front of me. So in that baby universe production, you will need to have a region where you would have to go through a violation of the energy conditions, or in the structure you put out?
Violation of the energy conditions. I don't think so. You have to go through a region, so you can, looks like this, right?
Yeah.
You can form these things without going through a region where classically would have been a singularity.
Okay. And that's the vertical angle problem.
This is R equals zero. So this is so these things, they form something like this, right? So they together And here I still have some finite surface area, and at some point they just disconnect. And this is the point of disconnection, so to say. So this is r equals 0. So this is r equals 2.
So in our universe, there's going to be a small loss of energy.
No, they have the ADM mass of these things is 0. It goes to 0.
But then indeed, there's never a particular moment where this thing split up.
A particular moment.
I guess what he's saying is it was slightly less than about to close. Maybe a quantum function could just close it and pinch it off. Is that what you mean?
No, I'm referring to delta T is bigger than h bar, right? Not less than h bar. So anything that happens at a certain moment takes away energy.
Sure, I mean, this is a classical diagram, so there is no expectation.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what you're saying.
The question is it zero or is it almost?
Well, what I had in mind there was the classical case, so I would have said it's zero.
But then in quantum mechanics, it would tell you that this thing never had a moment where it actually split up. It was, I have to integrate.
I see what you're saying.
For anything to change in anything, quantum mechanical, you need some spread in the energy. So is this different than that?
No, but I'm just saying, at least in our universe, in the end, if I would look at this, okay, well, I measure the energy in that's prime minus, I can measure the energy of prime plus, and do I notice a small difference?
But wouldn't it be that the energy in both of them was already
uncertain? Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, you would have just had a completely stationary history of
I understand.
Then it's different because it makes our observable universe effectively not a closed system.
Well, I was just responding. I was just trying to respond to this issue.
I'm not saying anything in one or the other way, but we could accept it that there's energy that can go into another universe. Yeah. But the question is then, okay, well, how does that feed into, the way we would formulate physics? At a microphysical scale, suppose that these things would, for example, when we talk about small black holes, I think that's one of the problems that people are talking about. Is that anything that you would do with quantum mechanics in this context might be happening then very frequently at very small scales. These things get formed all over again. And once you open a certain floodgate, you involve the thing making. Start affecting how we formulate small still physics as well. So what would be your conclusion? What's your lesson for what quantum theory of gravity should look like?
What I personally think it looks like?
Is energy going to be conserved?
I think energy is going to be conserved. The evolution will be unitary, and basically we'll have to figure out how the information comes out of this thing. Because I'm not a big fan of baby universes and permanent remnants.
So, but then you're sort of in the third category, where you say.
Yeah. I'm just mainly conservative.
But where it comes out quickly.
It comes out late. Whether it comes out, how fast it comes out, I don't know.
Maybe these things are long-lived or short-lived.
But that's what I just said.
I didn't understand what you just said.
I said, I don't know. What I was trying to say is that I don't find these arguments particularly convincing. But I accept that they are there, so. Mm-hmm.
And Samir's question, are you sure that they don't need a violation of the universal conditions?
To form the baby universes?
Because you have a trapped surface inside the black hole, and then the singularity theorems, certainly there's guarantee at least some singular point somewhere.
Yeah, Yeah, sure, but the base that we started from was to say the singularities are kind of taken care of by the
point. Oh, absolutely, yeah. So just in the classical regime, I mean... If you could be in such a regime that the notion of an effect in space-time didn't even exist, then you wouldn't be able to write down the Einstein's answer, and you couldn't say whether you had an effect in negative energy or not.
Yeah, that's always convenient.
But assuming you did, but there was enough of a space-time so that you could still define the Einstein's answer, then presumably the singularity theorems will apply and tell you that you need at least somewhere negative energy or a singularity. So that's all, I suppose, all they strictly say, but they strongly suggest from examples that you need some extensive negative energy in order to expand.
Yeah, so what I can agree on is that the theory of quantum gravity, whatever it is, needs to provide a mechanism to do exactly that. And so the singularity theory tells you that you need to run an idea. If it makes no sense to talk about it. So.
More questions? Thank the speaker again for a great.